bringing back the fish in rivers and streams all over the state. The removal of the Edwards Dam from the Kennebec River and the Great Works and Veazey Dams from the Penobscot made national news and ushered in a new era for Maine's sea-run fish. But the work is far from over. All over Maine, community groups, tribal nations, government agencies, and environmental organizations are working together to open up more waterways to anadromous fish like alewives and salmon. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss projects to remove dams, create fish passages, and reconstruct culverts all over the state, and what these projects mean for the health of Maine's environment and economy. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Over the past 20 years, the fish have been returning to Maine after a legacy of decline. Today, we'll learn about continuing statewide efforts to restore Maine's waters and sea-run fish and how that helps our greater environment and economy. My guests are John Banks, Director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Nation, Molly Payne Wynn, Freshwater Program Director with the Nature Conservancy, and Pete Dittesheim, Advocacy Director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine. We invite your questions and comments. What has the restoration of fish passage meant to you? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for being here. And Molly, I'm going to start with you for sort of the historical perspective. I understand we're at a pretty good place right now because of the work that has been done over the past 20, 25 years. But take us back before that. What was the state of Maine's rivers and streams in terms of fish run? Cleaning them up, the Clean Water Act wasn't enough, was it?
No, and I would just start, thank you for inviting me, Jennifer. I'm really glad to be here today. We have incredible annual migrations of sea-run fish that take place up and down the eastern seaboard. And in Maine, we have 12 native species of diadromous or sea-run fish. And what that means is that these fish spend part of their life cycle in the marine environment and part in freshwater. So they essentially journey to Maine rivers, as they have for time immemorial, to find spawning grounds and other critical habitat. When they have access to the habitat and conditions they need, these fish are really prolific. Historically, migrations were in huge numbers for thousands of years. On the Penobscot River, for example, it's estimated that historic runs of Atlantic salmon numbered in the tens of thousands annually. We know these fish were critical to human survival, starting with the Wabanaki communities and then following for the first Europeans who settled in Maine. And with the growth of European settlements, largely along rivers, not by chance, right? These fish moved up rivers and provided an incredible food resource for people that settled there. With the shift to industrialization, building dams and mills, really the access to habitat for these prolific fish populations was really impeded. And so dams, overfishing, pollution, those were all kind of the perfect storm for really drastic declines across the board.
John, I'm going to turn to you. Many of these waters flow through tribal lands, the Penobscot River, for example. How were tribal communities affected by the decline of the fish populations?
Well, I think the tribes have been affected tremendously by the loss of access to a food source that has been so critical to the sustenance of the tribes here in Maine. You know, for thousands of years, our tribes have subsisted off from the natural resources, and the most crucial of those, I think, were the fish runs. The tribes set up their villages along the rivers, and a lot of times there were villages set up where streams, come into the main stem of the Penobscot. Those tributaries where the fish would run up to spawn, those were critical areas for the tribe for thousands of years. So we really look to the river as a source of life for our tribe, as we've depended on those resources for thousands of years.
Mm. John, Pete, bringing you into the conversation, 1999, the removal of the Edwards Dam from the Kennebec, big news, really started the restoration of free-flowing rivers in Maine. Tell us what has happened since then. Sum it up. We talk about what's happened on the Penobscot, and then what's going on, what the movement is like when it comes to smaller streams around the state.
Sure, love to. So we just celebrated last year the 20th anniversary of the removal of the Edwards Dam. It was a dam that had been on the Kennebec in Augusta since 1837. And the removal of that dam really was the dam removal that was heard around the world. We had 1,000 people on the banks of the Kennebec watching as the dam was breached, and fish quickly then repopulated upstream spawning habitat that they hadn't been able to reach since 1837. And the recovery was almost immediate. There were fishermen catching striped bass all the way up in Waterville within days, 18 miles up the river. And since then, another dam, the Fort Halifax Dam, was removed in the Sebasticook River in 2007. 36 million alewives have made it up through the fish passage, the fish lift in Benton Falls. And speaking back to what Molly mentioned as a mass migration, this is a remarkable mass migration that happens in the spring and is really incredible to watch. And it's not just the alewives. Seal are chasing these alewives up the river, and as many as 55 bald eagles have been counted along this stretch of the Sebasticook in a single day. It's the largest alewife fish run in the world and the largest congregation of bald eagles in the eastern seaboard. And it's happened because of this opportunity to restore the health of our rivers. And with the removal of Edwards Dam, I think it's really opened up our minds to the possibility that we can, in fact, achieve a new balance in our rivers by removing some of the dams that are lower within the watershed that are the biggest obstacles to restoration of fish populations. And we've seen healthier rivers, improved quality of life for the communities along those rivers, improved real estate values, people rediscovering and reorienting back to our rivers. And dam removal has been one of the biggest success stories in a state where we've worked together on many environmental and conservation success stories, but this is really one of our best.
And Pete, let me ask you this. I remember reporting on the removal of the Edwards Dam back in 1999, and there was a big debate back then about whether this was symbolic of something greater, whether this was going to be the beginning of something, or whether it was what it was. It was the removal of one dam on one river. What do you think has been the impact in sort of the movement of the removal of the Edwards Dam?
Well, I think that dam removal demonstrated that if you give nature a chance, it will come back with a vengeance. And people quickly saw that the success of that dam removal was a reason to pursue other dam removals. And it absolutely set the stage for the Penobscot River Restoration Project that also is a project that has received international attention because of how significant it really is as a rebalancing of power generation and river restoration on that river. And, yeah, I was on the banks of that river when the bell was tolled and We had the Secretary of Interior and Brownie Carson and the Governor of Maine and reporters literally from Eastern Europe and Japan reporting on this signature moment where a dam which was being removed. The state of Maine has about 1,000 dams, and only about 100 of them generate power. So many of these dams have outlived their usefulness, and it's not really how people have thought about dams in the past. We've kind of seen dams as permanent on the landscape, and I think with Edwards Dam, we saw, oh, some dams maybe do outlive their usefulness, could be removed, and it would be good for the environment. That stretch of the Kennebec where the Edwards Dam was in the 1960s had massive fish kills because the river was a sewer, and there were only about 20 nesting pairs of bald eagle in the entire state because we had killed our rivers with pollution. We now have more than 700 nesting pairs of bald eagle in the state, and it's because the fish are coming back to the rivers in no small part because we've removed some of the dams that got between the sea run fish and their freshwater spawning habitat.
One reason we're doing this show today, this month, and not right in the middle of the migration is that there is a new book out this month telling the story of the Penobscot River Restoration Project. The editor of the book, Peter Taylor, was not able to call in today, but he sent this message about the book. He wrote, "Although numerous articles had been written about the Penobscot River Restoration Project, most of the story had never been brought together in one place and written down. We interviewed more than 50 people to learn about every aspect of the project, a grandmother whose grandchildren loved to look out her window at one of the dams, scientists, fishermen, members of the Penobscot Nation, philanthropists, community organizers, local business owners, and people in Washington, D.C. who helped secure federal funding, to name just a few. It's a truly inspiring story of people with diverse interests working together to help revitalize the ecosystem of the Penobscot River watershed and the Gulf of Maine." John Banks, I know it was 16 years, the Penobscot River Project. You were involved in all 16 years of that. Now that the fish are back, what has that meant to the Penobscot people?
Well, I think it means a lot to the Penobscot people. It's part of our cultural heritage and our, you know, our ancient traditions to have a relationship with the natural world. And I think the restoration of these migratory fish to the Penobscot River watershed returns some of that lost traditional activity because of the lack of fish. And I just wanted to say quickly about the book that you mentioned. I just think it's great that we're able to capture this project in a book, because to me, this project is much more, you know, it's much more about, it's much more than fisheries restoration and electric, you know, generating power. It really shows what can happen if people really choose to work together with a common vision. And to me, that was one aspect of this project that is so important. You know, we'll never be able to recreate this project exactly because of the uniqueness of the time and the space where the dams were. So it's just fantastic. It just gives me so much hope that so many people with diverse interests can come together to accomplish a common vision.
Molly, I want to bring you into the conversation to talk about the dams that Pete was mentioning, 1,000 dams in Maine. I remember years ago as a reporter doing a story about a project in which people were trying to map the dams of Maine, that people didn't even know how many dams there were or where they were. Has that happened? Do we even know what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, so we've had a significant effort to really understand what the problems we're facing as a state as far as fish passage go. But I would just start by saying that it's not just about the large dams. We have a ton of improperly sized and placed culverts that are also a really huge problem for fish, not only along the coast, but all the way inland where incredible brook trout habitat is. And so the Nature Conservancy, we just finished a really very collaborative 13-year effort to survey road stream crossings statewide. And we did so in collaboration with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Maine Audubon, many, many other partners. And essentially, we worked to document what these nearly 26,000 road stream crossings statewide from anywhere from Alfred to Allegash to Addison, you know, what they look like, what condition they're in, how are they impacting the ability of our incredible populations of sea run fish and migratory fish to access the habitat that they need to survive. And what we found is that about half of these are problems for fish passage. And so if you do the math, that's about 12,000 problems statewide. And interestingly, these problem crossings are actually really largely problematic for humans, too. And so essentially where you have constricted flow and places where rivers and streams aren't being allowed to act like rivers and streams, you get flooding problems. And that can be a real problem for municipalities and human communities as well. So it is the dams, yes, and we know that there are about 1,000 of various sizes, but it's also about the culverts too. And so that makes a really incredible opportunity to partner with local people on the ground, municipalities, to really fix the passage issues. And that in turn is actually, it's a win-win for humans, fish and humans, nature and people.
That's great. We have so many people calling in. I'm going to try to get to one before the break and go to Toby calling from Ellsworth. Hi, Toby. Go ahead.
Hi. So while economics are not my focus in life, I understand how important it is to community planning and decision making, especially today when we have so many financially insecure citizens. I would like to know about the economic studies of the tax revenue realized from, for example, a productive and healthy lake system that attracts sport fishing and boating and is real estate competitive for an area in relation to the tax benefits from the actual hydropower. And I just want to say I appreciate hydropower when it successfully generates electricity while successfully mitigating fish passage and sustaining a healthy ecosystem. But my in-laws live on Grand Lake in Mariahville, and they only just got the lake back from the summer drought. And I live next to Leonard Lake in Ellsworth. And as far as I can tell, it is some pretty dark water that passes this way. Having a biology background, I can't imagine fish breathe very well in this water. And alewives are so important to the coastal ecosystem. Given the failing coastal fisheries over the decades, how does the value of the energy produced measure up?
Sure. And Pete, I'm going to ask you to answer kind of quickly.
So there have been a number of really good studies on the impact of water quality on lake property values. And then that really directly relates to the health of those communities that are on those lakes. So there's a clear correlation both for lakes and for rivers between economic value of, and valuation of the property and business opportunities along clean water compared to degraded water quality. The reason we were successful in getting the Edwards Dam removed is we persuaded for the first and only time we persuaded the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that the economic benefits to the state of Maine of removal of that dam exceeded the value of continuing to operate that dam for the dam owner. So the economics clearly can be used as an argument in many cases for dam removals. But you also need to look at a much bigger set of values. As one person, Laura Rose Day, mentioned when this is in the book that John referred to. She said that we weren't buying the dams. We were buying the river back for the fish. And the significance of ecological restoration sometimes you can't put a dollar value on it, but what we're doing is restoring connections of healthy ecosystems that have been completely shattered over the last several hundred years, and we'll never get back to the full connectivity between the ocean and the deep inland reaches of our rivers and streams. But removal of some of these dams and restoration of fish passage through culverts is part of this larger effort to restore health and values, however you define them, to our environment.
Toby, thanks so much for your call. We are going to take a quick break. We're talking about fish passage in Maine. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bristol Seafood's My Fish Dish, garlic and herb butter shrimp and three other varieties, found in the freezer at your local Hannaford.
All of us sometimes keep our opinions to ourselves. What happens when a whole nation does this?
The system perpetuates itself by turning the victims into victimizers. Everyone becomes complicit.
Conspiracies of Silence, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
And that's coming up tonight at 10 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of Christmas with Kennerly, presented by Friends of the Kochmar Organ. This year's concert, filmed at Portland's Merrill Auditorium, will be available online from Saturday, December 12th through Monday, December 28th. Organist James Kennerly and special guests will celebrate the holidays with classic Christmas favorites. For complete details about Christmas with Kennerly, please visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're talking about the pioneering work of opening up our rivers to bring healthy fish populations back to Maine. Joining me, Molly Payne Wynn, who's Freshwater Program Director with the Nature Conservancy, Pete Dittesheim, Advocacy Director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine, and John Banks, Director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Nation. Share your comments or questions. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. So many calls and messages coming in. We ask that your email or Facebook post please be brief. Molly, I want to ask you, Pete was talking about the very large numbers of fish that have come back to Maine's rivers and streams as we've worked to, as you and others have worked to remove dams and upgrade culverts and other kinds of stream crossings. But the numbers are still nothing like they were historically, correct?
That is correct. The fish runs that we see, the numbers today really are a fraction of what they were historically. And I think that that's a testament to the work that we have ahead of us. I think the removal of the Fort Halifax and Edwards dams, the really innovative thinking around the Penobscot River Restoration Project and thinking about system-wide restoration is really going to be very important as we move into continued river restoration work here in the state. I think that one of the really incredible takeaways from the Penobscot Project that's really resounds internationally, Pete mentioned the Penobscot Project is really looked at as a model on the international stage for river restoration, really lies in the fact that we built these incredible partnerships. So the Nature Conservancy signed on to the project in 2006. We were extraordinarily lucky to have the leadership of the Penobscot Nation and partners of Atlantic Salmon Federation, Maine Audubon, American Rivers, and Natural Resources Council of Maine sort of lay the groundwork for the Penobscot River Restoration Project. This was a project that focused on restoration of all 12 species of sea run fish. So it wasn't just about salmon. And it looked at river restoration through a multi-dam watershed scale approach. And that has really built the momentum for us in the restoration community to continue the work not only in the Penobscot River watershed up in the headwaters, where there's still work to do to sort of connect critical salmon habitat, but elsewhere in the state. People saw sort of the ability to think holistically about river restoration and the fact that the work really goes beyond the boundaries of freshwater rivers. I mentioned the community impacts, the local community impacts. There are really important links. We're starting to understand how restoring populations of sea-run fish and freshwater ecosystems have impacts on the Gulf of Maine. So healthy rivers and healthy oceans are critically linked. We talked a little bit about earlier about just sort of the economic impacts for increased fish numbers. If we think about our lucrative Elver fishery in Maine and how that's such an incredible economic driver for some communities, we know that river herring are a prized lobster bait. And so the more increase in river herring runs, the more localized bait is available for lobster fishermen. There's incredible recreation opportunities that are being restored.
Sure. Molly, to your point, we have an email from the Maine Department of Marine Resources saying restoring rivers for fish helps to support the lobster industry by providing bait, helps to support communities by improving water quality and protecting road infrastructure, and helps to support the environment by providing seafood to plants and animals hundreds of miles from the Gulf of Maine. DMR staff have worked for decades to restore sea-run species to Maine's rivers by removing barriers, stocking fish into habitat, and conducting research to identify impacts sea-run species. There have been many big successes over the years, but there is plenty of work left to do. And for that, John, I want to turn to you. What is next? What is your next priority? Oh, shoot. We just lost Pete. We just lost John. I wanted to turn to John and ask him that question. But we'll go to Brett, who's calling from Hancock. Hi, Brett. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer and the panelists. This is a great conversation. Thanks for doing it. I just wanted to touch on the fact that these projects, so I work with a fisheries conservation group in Washington County called the Downey Salmon Federation. And what we find is every single one of these projects, just like this Penobscot restoration discussion and a book about it, is a story. So the Panamaquan, having a fishway rebuilt by us and some of our partners, the Passamaquoddy Tribe and the community of Pembroke and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Maine Department of Marine Resources, Inland Fish and Wildlife, people worked to fix that river and restore an alewife run. That happens on little streams in every community, not just down east where we work, but across the state. And it only works when everybody sort of joins focus like this panel has been discussing. And I think that's something to take away here is all these rivers, all these restoration projects, whether it's a fishway or a dam removal or just improving what's already there, is only done with people working together and sort of telling that story in the next page of it. So, you know, we've gone from a place where we had fish, we lost them, and now we can have them back. So this is great stuff, and I hope everybody out there who lives near a river can join in and help on their local fish run. So,
Brett, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to go to an email here from Mary. What has been happening on the Kennebec and Penobscot Rivers is wonderful. However, I live in Ellsworth, where during alewife migration, we still see dead fish and chowdered fish parts floating down the river because of the effects of turbines in the Ellsworth Dam. DEP has ruled against Brookfield, which runs the dam, in their bid to relicense it, but still the situation continues. Is there a capacity and will on the part of your organizations to tackle the Union River Dam issue and open up a river that historically supported an amazing abundance of sea-run fish? It would cost a fortune to remove this dam. Where can the money come from? I'm going to turn to you, Pete.
Well, our staff scientist has been following the situation on the Union, and there are a number of dams in this state where there's serious fish kills, mostly downstream migration going through the turbines, and a pretty strong case can be made for removal or some form of restoration, and some of them would be extremely expensive and a challenge for us to kind of move in that direction. But I commend the person who's raised the question, and this is really how the Edwards Dam conversation started 10 years before it actually happened. The community really needs to engage and think about what would be entailed in achieving a successful dam removal for whatever dam they may, you know, have near them that they're seeing problems with, and to think deeply about what the complicated path forward is to try to achieve that. We built these dams for very important reasons at the time, and removal of each one of them is a difficult, difficult process. The Edwards Dam was 10 years in the making to remove that, and the Penobscot project was 16 years in the making. It was about a $60 million project. So there are many different opportunities for significant improvement in fish passage in our rivers. And unfortunately, because of many of the challenges of the regulatory process and the cost of removal, we're not going to be able to implement all of those. So we do need to think about where we can, with the support of state and federal agencies and nonprofits and the community, achieve incremental progress wherever we can.
Calling in now, Eileen Bader-Hall, restoration specialist with the Nature Conservancy. Thanks for calling in, Eileen.
Thanks so much for having me.
I understand your work has been focused on smaller waters. What are you trying to do with streams?
That's right. And well, first of all, as has been noted by other speakers, the work that we are doing with private landowners to improve stream crossings for fish and other aquatic organisms is facilitated by a tremendous number of partners, including the Natural Resources Conservation Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Maine Department of Transportation, and a host of other state and federal and tribal and NGO partners. And so I just wanted to say thank you to all our partners. TNC certainly could not do this work alone, and we don't. But because Maine is the most forested state in the country and the vast majority of these forest lands are privately owned and also have thousands of road stream crossings on them, which Molly mentioned, there's this huge opportunity to work with landowners on upgrading road stream crossings so that these structures, like culverts, for example, are not acting as barriers to fish and allowing the stream to flow as it normally would. And so ways we are working with private landowners, we can provide both technical assistance, support in determining what is the issue and what the solution might be, as well as financial assistance to help landowners cover the cost of a new structure, like a bridge that more than fully spans the width of the stream. And so one of our primary means of providing support to landowners currently towards improving stream connectivity is through the Maine Aquatic Connectivity Restoration Project, which it's a project of the Natural Resources Conservation Services Regional Conservation Partnership Program, or RCPP, and TNC is the lead partner on this project. And so, for example, we recently worked with a landowner in Piscataquis County who owns a small family woodlot, and they reached out to us because they were having issues with the stream overtopping their road every spring and causing the road to wash out. And they really wanted to make an improvement that would not only make the road more stable, but also improve the health of the stream habitat and further their overall conservation goals for their land. And so the RCPP program was able to help by providing some cost share assistance, and that helped make covering the cost of the entire project a lot more doable. And so that's a resource that's available out there for landowners.
Eileen, is there a role for those that are listening right now and thinking, I'd like to get involved, for citizen science or volunteers?
Well, that might be a great question for Molly to answer. But if landowners have, you know, a road stream crossing on their land that they're interested in, they could reach out to their local NRCS field office or Google Maine TNC RCPP for more information.
Okay. And so I'll ask you, thank you, Eileen, for calling in. Eileen Bader-Hall, the Nature Conservancy's restoration specialist. And I'll turn to you, Molly. Is there a role for citizen science here, for volunteers?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we think is really critical, I shouldn't say we think, we know, is better documenting where these sea run fish are, where they're returning to, what their population numbers are looking like. And so because the sea run fish are coastwide and inland as well, we are starting a program with a collaboration with the Gulf of Maine Research Institute and their newly established Ecosystem Investigators Network, also with the Downey Salmon Federation and the Department of Marine Resources. And we've started building a community science project. So we're looking for volunteers statewide, and we have an event this evening at 4 p.m. It's an online webinar, and we're looking for folks who might be interested in getting out in the coming weeks. I know it's cold, but it's a great opportunity to get outside and connect with the rivers and streams in your backyard. We're looking for help documenting tomcod populations. And if you're a birder, especially, this survey may be of particular interest to you, because part of the data we need is essentially people documenting the birds that are feeding on these fish in small streams.
So even this time of year?
Yeah. So tomcod are really unique, and they do migrate at a different timing than the rest of our sea run fish. They're actually known as frost fish. And they have an antifreeze component in their blood that allows them to be migrating in the coldest points of the year. So they're fascinating fish. And if folks are interested in joining the training, even just to learn a little bit more about what tomcod are and why they're so cool, they can visit nature.org/Maine and scroll all the way down to the bottom and look for the training called Finding Frost Fish.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Molly. That sounds fun. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, offering an option of curbside pickup on books, movies, CDs, or video games. Curbside pickup is available at checkout at bullmoose.com.
I'm Tyler Thompson on the finance team here at Maine Public. And on this day in Maine's history in 1904, artist Gibeon Eldon Bradbury passed away. Born in 1833 in Salmon Falls, his family moved to Saco around 1845. And in 1860, he established his own business in Portland ornamenting, among other things, wagons and sleighs. He struggled to be considered an artist rather than a craftsman, and spent hours sketching from nature and painting landscapes. He exhibited his work at art expositions at local and county fairs and developed the following. His paintings can be found in various public and private collections in the Saco area. Happy birthday, Maine!
On this day in Maine's history was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications and listeners like you.
I'm Tanya Mosley. The United Kingdom begins vaccinating people with the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine this week, and a key FDA panel is expected to approve the vaccine for use here in the United States. We'll check in on the vaccine effort and how the current spike in COVID-19 is affecting the country. That's next time on Here and Now.
And Here and Now is coming up today at noon here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, opening up Maine's rivers and streams and bringing back healthy fish populations. Joining me, Pete Dittesheim with the Natural Resources Council of Maine, John Banks with the Penobscot Nation, and Molly Payne Wynn with the Nature Conservancy. Let's see here. We're going to go next to Landis Hudson, Executive Director of Maine Rivers. Landis, thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show. It's been wonderful to listen to. It's really exciting to be reminded of the stories that have brought us to the place that we're in Maine, which is one of being able to celebrate successes.
Okay, so I understand you have been involved with many different fish passage projects over the years. Tell us, I know I learned recently that the word fish ladder is sort of not accurate. How do you talk about fish passage projects, and what are we seeing around the state?
Well, fish ladder is actually easier to say, but fish passage is what we refer to as, you know, a technical fishway, and that's basically something that's built to allow fish to get over a dam or a remnant of a dam. So there are lots of technical options that we have to use in places where dams can't be removed. And that's what we've been working on our China Lake project, where we've been dealing with six dams and a relatively small stream. So this is a project that we are able to do because of the Edwards Dam removal and because of the removal of Fort Halifax. So each time there is a success, it allows more habitat to be accessed, so it can lead to greater successes. But it's all, honestly, fairly slow going. It takes a lot of work with a lot of people, a lot of vision and patience and persistence, and people like John Banks and Pete Dittesheim to really be able to take a deep breath and think about, you know, a solid decade or more of work. So it's been really wonderful for me to hear on the show that there's been a lot of discussion of dam removal, because we have learned over time that dam removals are much more effective and much less expensive than installing a technical, highly engineered fish passage structure. So fish passage is definitely an option, but it's what you do when you have an old dam that you can't get rid of, that you can't take out for various reasons, and you have to essentially retrofit, find something that can be built to allow the fish to get up a 10-foot or 20-foot or 40-foot height that they couldn't get up on their own.
Mm. Landis, are you working on anything now you want to tell us about?
Well, we are really finishing one amazing project on the Outlet Stream project. And in my mind, we're still celebrating because we were busy over the summer building a technical fishway at the Box Mill site. And it's kind of interesting. It's next to a huge old mill, which at one time I believe was the largest mill in Maine. That industry is gone, and so there's no longer a need to dam the river the way it was dammed up. And we've, with a large group of partners, the Department of Marine Resources, NRCS, Fish and Wildlife Service, two towns, other nonprofits, Maine Rivers, a lot of great folks helped us work on that. And so we now have fish that will be able to get past that first barrier and then upstream to another fish engineered site, and then past where we've removed two dams, we still have to install a fishway at the lake outlet, and we have one relatively small dam removal to do. So,
and where is that one, the Box Mill?
Yes, that's in North Vassalboro.
Okay.
Yep, so it's an area where when settlers came, it was a relatively small stream, and they needed the water power for grist mill and for industries, and so they built lots and lots of dams. None of them produced hydropower. None of them had federal licenses. So we were able to work with the dam owners to help find ways to remove them or install technical fishways. So it's a complicated project, and they all take a lot of patience and perseverance, but it's possible, and it's we always hope that work in one community on one river will inspire people in other communities to do the same, because the issues that we see are very, very widespread. There are so many dams in this state, and so few of them produce power. And old dams cause lots of problems for fish. They change the nature of rivers, really, by blocking them and increasing the temperature and changing the flows. So there's a lot of benefit to be found from removing old dams, but it takes a long time for people to kind of wrap their brains around that.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. Landis Hudson, Executive Director of Maine Rivers. We're going to go to Michael calling from Westbrook. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much. And thank you very much for having this segment on the show. It's very important. I'm president of the Friends of the Presumpscot River, and I could echo much of what Landis had just said about persistence and the changes in the river. We've been restoring the Presumpscot, since the early 90s, but particularly having gone through a FERC process, entered into that in the mid-90s. And just now, just a few weeks ago, we had wrapping up the removal and restoration of the dams at Sacarapa, which is in the heart of Westbrook. And uniquely, it has both it has a dam removal, and then it has a fish ladder, a fish passage, mechanical denial, basically, and then natural fish passage as well. So it kind of goes up one set of falls and then up another. And it's absolutely beautiful. And I think there's a lot to gather from the Presumpscot River. When talking about kind of river restoration downriver from that, there's a denial that we had worked to get put in. And one of the things too to talk about is the beauty of the river after the impoundment is down and that natural river comes back. There's 5 miles of restored river upriver from us.
Michael, thank you for calling in. And I will say that Debbie has also sent an email. Jane has posted on Facebook, living the dream in Westbrook, Maine, with the Presumpscot Regional Land Trust, yeah. Friends of the Presumpscot, and cities, towns, and volunteers working together to restore our river and streams. So thank you, Michael, for weighing in from Westbrook. We have an email here from Benjamin. Where would I go to see if a culvert, bridge, or dam in my town is a problem for fish passage? Molly, is there a map somewhere? Is there a resource?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've also just completed at TNC that I'm really excited about is that we've taken that 13 years of survey data and we've combined it with the latest fish habitat and species data from state and federal organizations. And we've created a customizable prioritization tool. We call it the statewide barrier prioritization tool. And it allows folks to go in and sort of prioritize which barriers to fish will have the most benefit when they're remediated in a number of scenarios. So it can be as fine scale as a particular town or as big as prioritizing the state. And so if you visit nature.org/Maine, I've actually written a blog post about the tool and would be happy to connect listeners into better understanding how to use that tool and think about prioritizing, not only based on ecological impacts, but also based on budgets, costs, opportunities, and thinking about how we focus the work that we're doing to have a bigger impact for fish passage. That's a great question.
We're going to go to Steve calling from Rome. Hi, Steve. We're short on time, so if you could be quick, that'd be great.
Excellent. First of all, thank you folks very much for taking the time, the effort, and the energy to, you know, put forward a good plan to protect Maine's waters, rivers, streams, and likewise. Without you folks, this doesn't happen. My question is, what can we do to preserve rivers, streams, and all classifications, class 1, 2, or 3, all the way up to 5-class streams, to preserve their intact habitat and good, healthy production that they currently have in regards to all of these streams and rivers that will be affected by the NECEC corridor? How can we preserve those waterways and not have to go into restoration mode that you folks are well aware of cost a lot of money?
Sure. Pete, go ahead.
Well, so we're at the end of this program, and getting into the whole NECEC would be something that a whole additional program deserves. But let me just mention that Maine has literally thousands of heroes who, over the decades, have been working relentlessly as advocates for clean water and for restoring our rivers and our lakes and our streams and our coastal waters back to something approximating what it once was. And it's DMR, it's the people in this program, it's the people who've called into this program, and there's just countless people who love the waters of this state. And our current caller is one of them, and I just encourage everyone who has fallen in love with a river or a stream or a lake or a coastal water area, get involved and be a champion and be part of the conversation to continue this collective effort to improve the health of our rivers and our waters and our lakes. It's great
stuff.
All
right. Well, Steve, thanks for your call. John Banks, so we lost you earlier, and I want to return to you and ask you, what are your next priorities? What are you hoping that we'll be talking about in 5, 10, 20 years on this program, what would you like to see as the success stories of the future?
Well, I think I'd like to see us, you know, looking back and seeing increasing numbers of migratory fish that are coming back to our rivers to spawn. So here on the Penobscot watershed, for instance, there's a bunch of dams coming up for relicensing that are very important to this watershed. You know, we've talked about some of the lower river dams that we've already taken out as part of the project. And then we talked about some of the culverts and bridge replacements in the upper watershed. Well, between those, we still have several dams on the Penobscot River that are in various stages of relicensing. We have the Mattaseunk Dam, we have the West Enfield Dam, and then we have a whole slew of dams up on the west branch of the Penobscot that will be coming up for relicensing. And all of these are critical to the continued restoration of the Penobscot River watershed.
And John, how controversial are those relicensing applications?
They can be very controversial. But I think this Penobscot River Restoration Project is just a great example of how to accomplish these things by making sure that we have everybody at the table that's impacted by these. And I'd like to just mention really quickly the Howland Project, which is the third project in the Penobscot River Restoration Project. Now, the removal of that dam was very controversial. So what we did was we worked with the town to meet their needs. They wanted to keep the dam in place so they could continue to use the impoundment for recreational purposes. And so we were able to work with the town successfully to have it both ways. So the dam stayed in place, so the impoundment is still there for the town to use recreationally. And then we have the fish bypass channel that we built around the dam, which provides for unlimited access by all of the migratory fish. So I think that's a great example of how people can work together, even when there is some controversy involved in the project.
Well, this has been such a popular program. So many calls and emails we were not able to get to, but we are putting resources on our webpage to the organizations involved in today's conversation. So thank you all for being a part of this. John Banks, who you just heard of from, is director of the Department of Natural Resources for the Penobscot Nation. Molly Payne Wynn, freshwater program director with the Nature Conservancy. And Pete Dittesheim, advocacy director for the Natural Resources Council of Maine. Today's sound engineer was Lucy Suchek. As I mentioned, resources on our website, mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.